Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to class. This is about 2:41, and it is October 6th. It is October 6th. All right, and we're going to get into a new chapter today. And that chapter is nervous system. That's chapter 7. We got 3 lectures on nervous system, so as you can imagine, that's a pretty important chapter. And we'll try to have as much fun as possible with that one. Here's the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign that. And I'm going to turn some of these lights down, just like so. All right, so if we look at the schedule, we see that you do have your second exam on October 20th. That's exactly 2 weeks from today. So I thought it was next week, but it's not next week. It's the week after, because we got 2 lectures this week on nervous system, and then next week, 1 on nervous system and 1 on autonomic nervous system. And that will be it for the test, because Chapter 10 or Sensory won't be on the test. But if you want to start looking at that ahead of time, that would be great. All right, so anybody have any questions over cell respiration? Because we covered that last time really nicely. Yes. Okay, let's see if I can find that, table 5.2. Okay, I bet I can. Like toward the end of the, maybe this one here. Okay, let's check it out. Oh, this is different than what's in your book, I think. 5.2, is that what you wanted to look at?
Yeah.
Okay. I like the one in your book better, because the one in your book gives you an additional column right here, which is the theoretical maximum, and I need to get an update of that slide. I like that. Okay, so what's your question? Krebs cycle, right here, Krebs cycle.
And if you go to where it says reduced coenzymes,
yeah.
Column,
okay.
It shows you there's 3 NADHs, right?
Yep.
Because Krebs cycle goes in twice. And then,
well, that's why this 2 is here.
Right. And then if you go to the last column,
yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And then why is it multiplied by 3? If you look at FADH1, FADH1 is already multiplied by 2. So you can see that in the last column.
Yeah, see this 2 right here corresponds to this one here. Is that what your question is?
No, it was the one right above. Where it says 2.582 for FADH2.
Okay, so we want to say 3 because we're looking at the theoretical best case. So 3 ATP. And how many for one turn of the Krebs cycle?
3.
Okay. But how many times does the Krebs cycle turn? Twice. So that's this 2 right here. That's how I read that. How did I do? Anybody that really knows this? Did I do good? I think I did. Okay. Yeah, it doesn't tell you what all these numbers are. You have to kind of figure it out as you go. Yeah, so this 2 means how many times the Krebs cycle turns. And this is because we get 3 for every one turn. Okay, so maybe it would have been better if they had like 3 times 2 right here, all in the same line. Would have made more sense to me. Okay. All right, so that's good. But I do like the figure in your textbook even better. All right, any other questions on this? The big thing that I want you to know is if you add up all of the ATPs for aerobic respiration, going through glycolysis and Krebs cycle and electron transport and all of that, how does that correspond to the ATPs made only through anaerobic respiration? Right, because there's a lot of discussion on how many ATPs are produced through electron transport chain, and that discussion is really interesting in some scientific circles. It's not so interesting for us or clinically. But the difference between aerobic and anaerobic respiration is important for us. And how would you compare the number of ATPs made?
About 30 in aerobic.
I like that.
And
2 in anaerobic. Yeah, and you don't even have to say about 2. You can just say 2. Okay, so 30-something for aerobic, 2 for anaerobic respiration. And I think that's pretty easy to understand because, for instance, if you're going to buy some gas for your car and the gas that you're going to buy is the same amount no matter where you get it, say it's $4 a gallon,
and you have a choice of two gas stations. One place you get gas where you can get 2 miles per gallon. Another gas station you can get 30 miles per gallon. What gas station would you go to for the same price per gallon? Yeah, the one that you get 30-something for, right? Okay. All right, so let me put this away unless you got another question. Do you know the difference between beta oxidation and lipolysis? Lipolysis? What is lipolysis?
Breaking down fat.
Breaking down fat. But isn't beta oxidation breaking down fat?
Aren't you breaking the fatty acids?
Okay, I like that. So lipolysis is the breaking down of a triglyceride into building blocks, which are fatty acids, namely 3, and a glycerol. Beta oxidation is the breaking down of those fatty acids into simpler forms, namely acetyl-CoA. All right, so beta oxidation takes fatty acids, breaks it down to acetyl-CoA, but lipolysis breaks down a triglyceride into glycerol and fatty acids. So different kinds of things. I'm sure you have some questions at the end of the chapter or online questions that ask that. Okay. Okay. All right, so I'm ready to move on to nervous system. And maybe I'll enable some editing right here. Not so important, maybe. Pointer options. Okay. All right, so the first part of this chapter is a review of anatomy. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time reviewing anatomy. I'll try to hit some of the salient points. And if I say something and it doesn't make sense, then you can ask me. I might refer to talking to you after class or just say, you know what, you just look in your anatomy book. All right, but I'll try to go over this pretty fast so that we can get into the physiology of the nervous system. Okay, so structure of the nervous system. How could we label this slide? Instead of structure of the nervous system, we could say, instead of structure, what would we replace this word structure with? Anatomy, perfect. All right, so anatomy of the nervous system. And is that what this class is about, anatomy? It is not, right? So this stuff you should pretty much know already. We want to get to physiology of the nervous system. All right, so here is the anatomy really, really fast. So the nervous system can be broken down into two main areas, and that is central nervous system, which is brain and spinal cord, and peripheral nervous system, which is defined as everything else besides the brain and spinal cord. Everything outside the central nervous system is peripheral nervous system. So you might think of some cranial nerves and some spinal nerves. Where do cranial nerves originate from? The brain. How many are there? You should know even their names and functions a little bit, right? And spinal nerves, probably not so important that you know how many there are. I think there's 31 pairs and what their function is. But cranial nerves, probably a little bit more important to know. All right, and just like we can break down the nervous system into two main areas, we can break the cells that make up the nervous system down into two types. And the two types of cells are neurons and neuroglia cells. Sometimes they're called glial cells. Sometimes they're called supporting cells. Right? And this statement is a little bit misleading. It says neurons are the functional units of the nervous system. That's pretty much true. And it also goes on to say glial cells maintain homeostasis, and there are many more glial cells than there are neurons. Well, this is true. Okay, this statement was true. Neurons are the functional unit of the nervous system. This is true in the past. Right, and now we know that glial cells or support cells are doing so many important kinds of things inside the brain and peripheral nervous system that it's really an oversimplification to say that neurons are the functional units in the nervous system. And I'll point some of those things out, but the glial cells do when we get there. All right, so we have neurons and glial cells. Neurons can transmit information very rapidly over long distances in your body in the form of a nerve impulse. So that's what a neuron does. It uses nerve impulse, electrical impulses, which travel very rapidly. Glial cells, on the other hand, have all kinds of different kinds of functions. They might instruct neurons where to grow, how to grow, whether they can grow back or not. And it can do a bunch of other things that we're going to talk about. Okay, but they do not send electrical impulses long distance. Okay, so let's look at neurons first. So they gather information. Right, so they receive information, so there's a receiving end to every neuron, and then they transmit that information. And that's the other end of a neuron. The receiving end is what we call a dendrite. The sending end or the transmitting end is what we call an axon. And then there's a cell body that's in between these two. And because they gather and transmit information, they respond to stimuli. Since they're gathering information from a number of different places, they can act, even a single cell can act as an integration center, and it can make a decision on what to do with that information. All right? And if it decides to send that information along, it can produce other electrochemical impulses that we're going to look at, and these things will travel down an axon, which is a sending end of a neuron. And at the axon terminus, that information is transmitted to other cells, usually not as an electrical signal, but as a chemical signal. And the structural and functional unit of communication between cells is what we call a synapse. And the kind of synapses that we're going to be looking at are what we call chemical synapses. In the heart, we're going to talk about another kind, but in the nervous system, we're going to be looking at chemical synapses. So here we got a couple illustrations. You've seen these illustrations before of some neurons, and there's actually some glial cells here as well. Here's a neuron, and it's going to be in this gold color. The support cells are, to me, looks like a little beige color. And the short processes are dendrites. This is the major part of the neuron, including the nucleus and a bunch of machinery for making proteins, which is what? Rough endoplasmic reticulum. And then the electrical signals that are acquired by the dendrites, that information is sent into this area, the axon hillock. And if it is a proper, meets certain criteria, then a neuron will generate a nerve impulse which moves down the axon to these axonal termini right here. And what can you tell me about that nerve impulse? Does it move one way or can it move both ways along an axon? It moves one way. And we'll find out why that is a little bit later on, but that is true. Information always goes from dendrite to cell body, down an axon to the axon terminus. And some axons can have branches, so we call those collaterals. This right here is a support cell. Kind of looks like a roll of toilet paper around the axon. I can see the axon peeking out right here. This is what we call a Schwann cell. Schwann cells are located in the peripheral nervous system. And really briefly, what a Schwann cell does, it allows a nerve impulse to skip down the axon very rapidly, right? If this was a non-myelinate, well, the chemical that the Schwann cell produces is called myelin. And if this axon is not myelinated, then the way that that electrical impulse travels down the axon is slow. And it's about 100 times faster when an axon is myelinated. This kind of cell right here, can anybody recognize the shape of this neuron? It's got a name, the shape of this neuron. Multipolar. I heard multipolar somewhere. Somebody kind of mentioned that under their breath. This is a multipolar neuron. And the function of a multipolar neuron is that it is, okay, a motor neuron. And it can be an association neuron. So how is a motor neuron sending signals between the peripheral and central nervous system? Which way does a motor neuron send a signal? Where does it start? Where does it end up? Motor, another name for motor is efferent. So signals are leaving the central nervous system and going to the periphery. So motor, CNS to periphery. As opposed to afferent or sensory, information is going from periphery to central nervous system. And the cell on the bottom is an afferent or sensory neuron. And does anybody know this neuron by shape? I see one process coming out, but it's really, really short. So this is a pseudo-uni. It's uni, but it's pseudo because it's very, very short. Pseudo-unipolar neuron. And this one is always going to be a sensory neuron. So it is afferent. And I see that there are two processes. One is going to be the peripheral process that's in the peripheral nervous system, and the other is going to be in the central nervous system, so we're going to call that the central process. And when you see a picture of that, it will make really good sense. Okay. This cell body right here, this is a, so here's that pseudo-unipolar neuron. This cell body is going to be outside of the central nervous system, and there's going to be groups of thousands of these together. And what do we call a group of thousands of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. That's what we call a ganglion, right? And if there are a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system, we don't want to call it a ganglion. We want to call it a nucleus, right? And notice that the cell bodies are not myelinated. So when you look at these in real life, those areas where cell bodies are, they look darker. They look gray. Areas that have axons that are going someplace, that are myelinated, they look white. So that's the difference between white matter and gray matter. Okay, dendrites, axons, dendrites receive information, axons transmit. That's really good to know. They have different kinds of membrane proteins. This we didn't learn in anatomy, so maybe I'll mention that very quickly. The dendrites are receiving information, and that information is transmitted to them via a chemical. A chemical will bind to certain structures on these dendrites that we call receptors, and as a result, that will change the permeability of the cell membrane to various ions, like, for instance, sodium ions. And that will change the electrical property of these dendrites, and those electrical properties then flow over the cell body to the axon hillock. And in the axon, it has a different kind of membrane protein. In the dendrite, we have ligand-gated channels. That means that a signaling compound has to bind to that channel to open it or close it, right? But the kinds of channels that we have in an axon are what we call voltage-gated channels. So what changes the state of those channels is just the voltage across the cell membrane. All right, so a lot of this sounds like gobbledygook until we look at it in the next three lectures. Okay. All right, so not only do electrical impulses move up and down an axon, but stuff can too, physical stuff. And there are two different ways that material can move along an axon, right? And we're not talking electrical signals, but molecules. There's axoplasmic flow. Axoplasmic flow moves soluble compounds, right, toward the nerve endings via a contraction that just looks like a lot like peristalsis. Peristalsis is a contraction that your digestive tract goes through to move material through your digestive tract. Okay, and there is another way called axonal transport. And there are some organelles inside cells that are known to be able to move things around, to position things within a cell, and even to push and pull on a cell membrane to change the shape of a cell. Does anybody know what those little organelles are called? Microtubules, I heard it, microtubules. So this axonal transport relies on microtubules. Microtubules like a monorail inside of the cell. There are things that can hop onto that monorail and get transported from one side of the cell to the other or manipulated somehow within the cell. And so there are two ways, right? So things can move in an antegrade fashion. Antegrade just moves things from the cell body down the axon, pretty much like a nerve impulse is moving the same direction. Antegrade means the forward direction. Forward would be from cell body into an axon down to the axon tip or terminus. Retrograde is the other way around, where something can move from the axon terminus back into the cell body. And there are different kinds of proteins that are associated with the microtubules that do that. The kinesin kind of motor protein is one for antegrade transport, and the dynein protein is for retrograde transport. So these are just different shapes of proteins that can move in different directions along an axon. All right, so things can move from the tip of an axon into the cell body with retrograde transport using these dyneins, and there are even some viruses and toxins that have been able to figure out how to hop a ride on these microtubules that are inside of an axon to actually find their way to the cell body. And they can be dormant in that cell body for many, many years, many decades even. Okay. All right, so here we have a pretty good illustration. Let's see, I think there's something left off of this slide and I'll figure out what it is. But we have the two major divisions of the nervous system, right? We got CNS and PNS. And I got a number of different cells. Like this top one right here, remember, we call that a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar neuron. And what was the function of a pseudo-unipolar neuron that we were just talking about? Sensory. So Here I see an arrow going from periphery into central nervous system. Is that true for sensory? Is that an afferent signal pathway from PNS to CNS? Indeed it is, right? So information is entering the central nervous system if it is sensory, and the pseudo-unipolar neuron is designed to do that. Where is the cell body located on this illustration? Is it in the CNS or a peripheral nervous system? Peripheral nervous system. And there's going to be thousands of these neurons all grouped together. All those nerve cell bodies will be in the same location. So what are we going to call that clump of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? It's going to be a ganglion, right? Okay. All right. And so that's a really good sensory. Here, the second one I see right here. Can you tell this one by shape what this is? That's a nice multipolar neuron. One of the functions of multipolar neuron is a motor neuron or an efferent, right? And so this is taking signals from CNS to peripheral nervous system, and I see the direction of the arrow. And here I see a somatic motor neuron, and that I think is important because for the somatic motor outflow pathway, you should know what the effector organ is. What's going to produce a response when a nerve signal comes down a somatic motor neuron? It's going to go to skeletal muscle, right? That pretty much means the same thing. Somatic means to some part of your body that's not deep inside a body cavity, more superficial regions of your body. And hence, we have a tendency just to think of it as your body. Skeletal muscle is innervated by the somatic motor nervous system. And how many neurons does it take to get from CNS to PNS? It just takes one, all the way there, right? Okay, here is another outflow pathway, and I see the cell body in the central nervous system, and the axon is moving into the peripheral. So this is another example of what, an afferent or efferent pathway? CNS to periphery is efferent or motor. So here's another motor outflow pathway, but this is an autonomic motor pathway, and I think you should be able to recognize that because it is not just a single neuron, it is two neurons back to back. Right, and there's going to, the second neuron, the cell bodies are going to be in the peripheral nervous system. There's going to be a clump of these nerve cell bodies someplace in the periphery. And what are we going to call that clump of nerve cell bodies? A ganglia, just like we call this one up over here, a ganglia. And so there are autonomic ganglia found in different locations outside the central nervous system. So these two cells, the one coming from the central nervous system is called the preganglionic cell. Preganglionic neuron, and the one that's completely in the peripheral nervous system is called the postganglionic cell. When we get into the autonomic nervous system in a couple lectures, that's going to be important for you to know. The other thing right now that you should know is, what are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? Is it skeletal muscle? It's never skeletal muscle. What could it be? It's nicely labeled on this slide. It could be smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, or glands, right? Those are the effector organs. So this is why we call this an efferent motor neuron. The thing that's not on this slide is a multipolar neuron, which is found completely within the central nervous system. So you could draw one in. You could draw some dendrites and a cell body and an axon. Just make sure that you don't draw it ever leaving the central nervous system. So just draw it within the spinal cord right here. And it's going to be a multipolar neuron. And if it's completely within the CNS, then we call that an association neuron or an interneuron. Because that's what's going to connect these afferent signals to these efferent signals. There has to be a neuron, or there is usually a neuron in between those two, an association. Or an integration neuron, or an interneuron. All right, one thing I forgot to mention, sometimes it's a little bit confusing. Let's go back to the pseudo-unipolar neuron. All right, so there is one process coming out of the cell body, bifurcates into two long processes, right? And both of these we would like to call axons. But the axon that's in the peripheral nervous system is called the peripheral part of this axon, and the one that goes into the central nervous system is called the central process, right? Peripheral process versus central process, just basically by its anatomy. That's only for that pseudo-unipolar neuron. Right, because all these others only have one process, so you never get that confused. Right, even if it starts in the CNS and ends up in the peripheral nervous system. Right, so here are the three general kinds of neurons. Right, and you've got this nice sensory, you got a really nice motor or interneuron, and in between the two, this is one that some people were thinking about just not too long ago. This is the true bipolar neuron. And it has a really long dendrite with a lot of branches and relatively short axon. So this is not a very long cell. This is used for special signal processing capabilities that we find in our special senses. Now remember, we have five special senses. They're not located all over our body. Olfaction would be one. Vision would be one. We would find these bipolar neurons in special senses, like for vision and for olfaction. Okay, so they're a special kind of sensory neuron. All right, so those are the neurons. What's the other kind of cell that make up nervous tissue? We got done talking about neurons. Just a quick introduction would be the support cells or the glial cells. All right, so let's talk about some of these cells. And let's break down what we know about glial cells into two locations, peripheral versus central or peripheral nervous system. And we're going to start with peripheral nervous system. Here's that nice multipolar neuron, really long axon. Remember, nerve impulses only go in one direction. And this cell is what we call a Schwann cell. It's wrapping itself around an axon. I see many, many layers right here. This is what we call the myelin sheath. So there is a fatty compound in all these layers, which we call myelin, and that acts like insulation. It prevents electrical events that are in the axon from leaving the axon. Just like if you were going to unplug your toaster in the morning and you're going to grab the cord, right? You'd only grab that cord if it has insulation around it, not if it was a bare wire, right? So that's what these Schwann cells are doing. The very outer layer right here does have cytoplasm in it, not necessarily myelin. Myelin as in all these deeper layers. This outer layer that has cytoplasm, including this nucleus, that's what we call the neurilemma. Neurilemma is just the outermost layer. Myelin sheath are the inner layers. Notice that these Schwann cells are not continuous, but there are gaps between them, and we call these nodes, nodes of Ranvier. And this is how a nerve impulse moves. It moves from one, it jumps from one node to the next. It just hops over the whole length of a Schwann cell. And when that happens, right, that speeds up the rate of that impulse transmission. So it's faster. So what's better, faster or slower? Faster is better. Yeah, it's just like one of those commercials. All right, this is just a nice slide that shows how a Schwann cell wraps itself around an axon, and I can see some fascicles inside this axon, but that is just one axon from one cell. It's not many, many cells all joined together. All right, it insulates an axon. What did else? I wanted to say something else. All right, oh yeah, I remember. Okay, so this type of support cell aids in regeneration of this axon when it's damaged. When this axon is cut, for instance, this distal end of the axon is going to die and degenerate, but these Schwann cells are still complete cells, and they can form a tube, right? They can form a tube that goes to the effector organ. And so the axon from this multipolar neuron in the, what part of the nervous system? Peripheral nervous system can regrow and re-innervate some effector organ like skeletal muscle. So somatic motor neurons can grow back if they're damaged to re-innervate an effector organ. That is not so in the central nervous system. Once an axon is damaged in the central nervous system, there's actually something that prevents the regeneration. And that's kind of almost sort of a sad thing, because when somebody has spinal cord injury, then the spinal cord never regenerates, at least with the current technology that we know. So we'll have to consider why that is so, and there's some important reasons. All right, so let's jump from PNS into central nervous system. And here we have, I think we got five different kinds of glial cells, all doing a little bit different function. Nonetheless, I do see some multipolar neurons, right? I can see some axons. I see a capillary, I see a blood vessel going through. and this is part of the brain, for instance. There are chambers inside the brain that don't contain nervous tissue, but fluid. What are those chambers called? There are lateral ones. There's a third one. There's a fourth one. These are called ventricles. Yeah, those are called ventricles. And so there's a layer of cells that separate the nervous system, right, the nerve cells in the brain from the cerebrospinal fluid in these ventricles, and they're called ependymal cells, right? So that helps protect the brain from things that might be harmful to it in the cerebrospinal fluid. So that's a nice barrier. But these ependymal cells also help make cerebrospinal fluid in a couple locations. What are those things called that can make cerebrospinal fluid, which is a combination, a special combination of capillaries and ependymal cells? They can make a choroid plexus. Is that on the tip of anybody's tongue, choroid plexus? Go back and look and see where those are. Okay. All right, what about some of these other cells? Well, we talked about a Schwann cell. It wraps a myelin sheath around an axon, speeding up the rate of impulse conduction. The central nervous system has a similar kind of cell, but it's called an oligodendrocyte, and that's where I have the cursor right now. All right, so an oligodendrocyte can wrap a myelin sheath in multiple locations along an axon. Schwann cell, only one location. But that's not all. An oligodendrocyte can wrap myelin sheaths at multiple locations on one axon, but also additional axons. All right, so it has many different processes that can form a myelin sheath. But the job is still the same. It speeds up the rate of impulse conduction. When somebody has multiple sclerosis, it is these parts of their central nervous system, of these oligodendrocytes, that degenerate and form plaques. And as such, then the axon loses that ability to transmit action potentials or nerve impulses very rapidly, and it just messes up the timing of how events are processed in somebody's brain. Okay, so that would be multiple sclerosis. These oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system prevent regeneration. If this axon is cut in the central nervous system, then oligodendrocytes actually inhibit the regeneration of that axon. And as a result, these axons, once damaged, never grow back, and somebody will have that deficit, right, for the rest of their life. All right, so in the central nervous system, it's important to prevent regeneration, to just control how fast, right, these nerve cells can grow, because if they grow very rapidly, then that would be a tumor. Right? And if these cells learn how to metastasize or move to different parts of the body, then that would be cancer. Right? So that's the important function of why cell regeneration is usually limited in the central nervous system. Right, what's another kind of cell I see? Ah, right here, microglia cells. These cells are like the Langerhans cells in the epidermis, or the dendritic cells in the epidermis. Anybody remember something about the integumentary system from anatomy? What does that dendritic cell do? It fights infection. It's an immune cell. Same for these things, right? Microglia cells are immune cells. They help prevent infection of the central nervous system. Right, they might be able to recognize certain tumors in the central nervous system and then destroy those cells before they can cause a lot of damage. And then the last cell that we're looking at is an astrocyte. It kind of reminded somebody like a star. So here is the main body of the star, and then there's like light rays being emitted in all different directions. And these processes can attach themselves to a blood vessel, or they can attach themselves to the nerve cell body, or a dendrite, or even an axon of a neuron. And so the astrocyte has some really important features. It can take nutrients from this capillary because, right, that's what a capillary is designed to do, is to share things. Things can move in and out of a capillary. That's the only vessel that can. It can take nutrients from a capillary and deliver it directly to a neuron cell body or other location on a neuron. Right, so it's a door-to-door delivery system. That is really handy. The other thing that an astrocyte can do is that it forms a continuous barrier over this capillary. There are some things that can move through these perivascular feet by diffusion, but most things can't. So anything that you have in your blood does not have access to your brain, because some of those compounds would be really harmful. And guess what? We need to have a functioning brain every second of our life, right? It can't be diseased or damaged. And so the astrocyte also makes something called the blood-brain barrier, right? That prevents a lot of things that are in the blood from getting into the brain. As a matter of fact, there are a lot of pharmaceutical agents that we would like to have an effect in the brain. We can get them into a person's blood, maybe by taking a pill, injection, or whatever, but they can't get into the brain because the blood-brain barrier is preventing that from happening. So if a drug that we want in the brain can't get in because of the blood-brain barrier, then it has to be redesigned or modified so that it can. And you can imagine, that's very expensive to redesign a drug just so that it can get into the brain. All right, another job of an astrocyte is that it has to do with regeneration and the architecture of the central nervous system. So we just looked and saw that the brain really does not like to regenerate. Most of the neurons that we have in our brain, we had as a fetus, right? Most neurons develop fetally. But sometimes, and we've learned that in some parts of the brain, that this astrocyte can stimulate the regrowth or redifferentiation of stem cells into true neurons. Astrocytes can also tell this neuron where the axon should go, okay, and also where the dendrites and how many dendrites the cell has. So the astrocyte can determine how many interconnections there are between cells. It can increase the number of synapses. It secretes a compound called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and it promotes, right, the regeneration of nerve cells. It promotes a long lifespan of these neurons, and it also adjusts the interconnectivity of these neurons, which means that it can help build the network of neurons that are inside somebody's brain. It can enhance the network, which is what we understand to be the function of intelligence. That comes from chemicals from these astrocytes, or BDNF. And one part of the brain that is really known for this to happen is the hippocampus, part of the limbic system. Hippocampus, we know, is important because it can convert short-term events or memory into long-term memory. And it's aided with neurotrophic factors from astrocytes. And there are certain conditions where the hippocampus will atrophy, right? And as that atrophies, people have a hard time learning new things. And also coping with their environment, stressful situations. And somebody that has clinical depression has an atrophied hippocampus. So somebody with clinical depression has a really hard time learning new things, right, because of that. And fortunately, there are some really good treatments for clinical depression. And guess what we see? We see that person's hippocampus actually growing back, coming back. So that is really, really nice. All right, so all of these glial cells have some really important kinds of functions. And let me scan through some of these slides. I think I've talked about all of these things already. All right, axonal regeneration happens in the CNS but not PNS because the myelinating cells are different, Schwann cells versus oligodendrocytes. Here is nerve regeneration happening. Would this be in the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Peripheral, because these are Schwann cells, right? So when this axon is damaged, these Schwann cells can form a regeneration tube, and that guides the growth or regrowth of an axon to this particular target tissue. Right? And in this particular case, it looks like a nice skeletal muscle. So Schwann cells will enhance regeneration. Okay, neurotrophins I talked a little bit about. I didn't mention it promotes fetal nerve growth. It can do so in the adult as well. And it's required for survival, maintenance of adult neurons. And it's also important for regeneration. And, okay, maybe I'll talk some more about this. But anyway, when you take a class like this, because of the function of those astrocytes, you have many more kinds of connections between nerve cells in your brain when you learn things, especially in the hippocampus. And So you won't have the same kind of brain after you take a class like this compared to the brain that you had before you took a class like this. The shape of your brain is changing, which means what? If the shape of your brain is changing, what does that mean? It's so hard. The function of your brain is changing. That's right. It cannot happen overnight, right? So you can't take an anatomy class or physiology class in 1 week, right? Because it takes a little while to make those changes. And I'm just always astounded that students like you actually hand your brains over to somebody like me to rebuild your brain, right? That's what happens with all of your instructors. Actually, all of your associations that you have with anybody. All right, so be careful who you associate with, because what will happen? Your brain is going to be redesigned and rebuilt, right? So hang out with the people that you think are going to be beneficial to you. Okay, astrocytes, the most common. I talked about regulating neurogenesis, all right, some other things. It can adjust potassium levels. That's an important ion that's extracellular, and later on in this chapter we're going to see how important that is. It can recycle neurotransmitters. So neurons communicate with each other via a chemical synapse. That chemical is what we call a neurotransmitter, and these astrocytes can help recover some of these neurotransmitters and put it back into the presynaptic cells so that it can be used again to transmit information. And as I said, they can release other kinds of factors that can regulate, right, neuronal activity and neuronal growth. So astrocytes are really important in doing that. Blood-brain barrier, result of astrocyte, talked about that. All right, so that's a pretty quick tour of the structure of, or the anatomy of, the nervous system that is important fundamental information for what we're going to talk about. So be able to recognize those different neurons by shape and know what their function is, because the shape is different. All right, so resting membrane potential. I'm going to just call this RMP for right now. Resting membrane potential, we're going to look at, especially for neurons, but it's going to be the same for every cell in your body. That just means that every cell in your body acts like a battery, okay, believe it or not. And that means that the inside of the cell is going to have a different kind of electrical charge compared to the charge outside the cell, right? And if you have a battery with two terminals, that's just what you would measure with a battery. The voltage on those two terminals is different. And since there's a gradient in electrical charge, then that can be used as an energy source to do work. Those electrical particles will move. And how are they going to move? Will opposite charges attract, or will they repel each other? They will attract each other, right? So electrons will flow from one terminal to another because they have opposite charges. Okay, so all cells at rest have a negative internal charge, and we saw how that developed in a previous chapter. And that's due to what? Unequal distribution of ions, but also those negative charges that are trapped inside the cell, those big ions, and the sodium-potassium pump, and a whole bunch of other things, right, contribute to that resting membrane potential. So RMP stands for a cell, and is that cell doing anything, or is it just sitting there? It is just sitting there. That's what rest means. It's not doing anything. It's not sending information. It's just ready to do something, but nonetheless, it is at rest. And M just stands for membrane. We're going to measure something across the membrane. And P stands for potential. And there's maybe another word that would be better suited to be put in this position, and that would be voltage. Resting membrane voltage is exactly the same thing as resting membrane potential. Right, and people like to use that word potential because if there's a separation in charge, there is potential to do something. Those charges will want to neutralize each other. Right, but you could just say voltage. All right, so what does it result from? Oh, I just mentioned that. Those large, look at that. I should change the slide. Large cations being trapped inside the cell. What is it? They're anions. Yeah, cross that off. Hopefully you caught that, right? Sodium-potassium pump. Remember, the equal numbers of sodium and potassium are not pumped against their gradient, right? There's unequal, 3-2. And so that keeps sodium at a high concentration outside the cell and potassium at a high concentration inside the cell. Let's see, what else? Potassium is very permeable. Even though it's high inside the cell because of this pump, right, it can diffuse across the cell membrane pretty rapidly, and it is attracted inside the cell because of these anions, right, that are inside the cell. Sodium, on the other hand, is restricted. It cannot move through the cell membrane. Potassium can't move through the cell membrane by itself either, right, because potassium and sodium ions are hydrophilic. And what kind of compounds can move across the cell membrane by themselves? Only hydrophobic, right, or nonpolar compounds. So they have to have a channel. Both sodium and potassium have to have some kind of channel so that they can move by diffusion or by some electrical attraction through that cell membrane. All right, neurons are excitable. That just means that something can change their electrical properties. And we call that discharge of their resting membrane potential very quickly by rapid changes to the permeability of that membrane to these various ions. Right? Both neurons and muscles work pretty much the same way. You'll be a little bit surprised by that, to generate and conduct electrical impulses. And this relates from that one question that we had on the test that I drew on the board. And it was not a correction for that question. It was just to reinforce how important that is. Remember, there are two forces that are working on an ion, okay, from inside to outside. And the question had to do with sodium, I believe, with sodium. And so let's think of those two forces. Why is sodium going to want to move across the membrane? One, by concentration gradient from high to low, so we call that diffusion. Right, and then there's something else that will move sodium across the cell membrane, and that is the electrical charge inside the cell. All right, so let's just think of that in our mind. Where is sodium at a high concentration? Outside the cell, low inside the cell, so what will sodium want to do? It will want to go inside the cell just by the chemical distribution. Now, what about the electrical properties? What can you tell me about the charge on sodium? It's positive, plus one. What about the charge inside the cell? Negative. So what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract. So the electrical force is pulling sodium inside the cell. What about the chemical force? It's pulling inside the cell. So as soon as a pathway opens up for sodium, like a channel opens up, which way is sodium going to go? It's going to rush inside the cell because of the electrical gradient as well as the chemical gradient, right? And so that's why cells can be excitable, right? They can change their electrical properties rapidly when the permeability to, for instance, sodium changes across the cell membrane. All right, and as sodium moves inside the cell, down its chemical concentration gradient and down its electrical gradient, what happens to the charge inside the cell? Because right now at rest, it's negative. It's going to neutralize that negative charge, and the inside the cell will become less and less negative and even become positive at some point in time. Okay, so that's what produces that excitability. Okay, so both neurons and muscles do this to generate and conduct electrical impulses. This slide will define a couple terms for us that are very important. Here I see a nice neuron, looks like a nice multipolar neuron. Here's an axon, nice long axon. Is it myelinated? No, this is a slow conducting kind of axon, a couple miles an hour, maybe 5 miles an hour. If it was myelinated, it would be hundreds of miles an hour, so it's slow. Not so important for this slide, right, but you should just know something about myelinated versus non-myelinated axons. Here we have something that looks like a TV screen. We call this an oscilloscope, and there is a little dot that moves from right to left, okay, depending, and it can move faster or slower depending, and that's a time scale. So this is going to measure something versus time, and what this oscilloscope is going to measure is voltage. And in order to measure voltage, you need to have two electrodes, right? If we're going to measure the voltage on a battery, one electrode you place on one terminal, the other electrode you place on the other terminal, and depending on the difference of those two terminals in electrical charge, then this dot is going to go up or down depending on the voltage, right? And we can see how it changes over time. And we can do this with a cell, because we said a cell, every cell in your body acts like a battery. It's negative on the inside when it's at rest, and so it's positive on the outside. If we stick an electrode inside the cell, then we can measure the electrical difference across the cell membrane. And you might be wondering, oh, well, how do we get an electrode inside the cell? And you know what? It's not really difficult at all. You can just take a glass tube, and what happens to a glass tube when you put it in a Bunsen burner? Anybody ever do that with glass, a glass tube? It gets really runny, right? You can bend it. That's how people blow glass, for instance. And if you put a glass tube over a Bunsen burner and get it kind of soft and then pull it really fast, then you can imagine that the tips get really narrow and narrow and narrow and smaller and smaller and smaller before it breaks. And that glass tube is microscopic by the time it breaks, right? And that you can stick inside of a cell and use that as an electrode. So you can measure the voltage across the cell membrane, just a single cell, and display it. So on this oscilloscope. So the axes, we're going to get a graph. And remember, every time you look at a graph, you want to know what the axes of that graph are. It's going to be voltage on the vertical and time on the horizontal. So we're going to get a plot of voltage versus time. Voltage versus time. And that voltage is going to be measured across the cell membrane. All right, and so what I see right here is a nice voltage when the cell is at rest. So what's the voltage? This is going to be a typical cell. Not all cells are identical to this, but an average cell is going to have this voltage across the cell membrane when it's at rest. What can you read? Okay, here is zero, and that voltage is way down over here, and that is what? Minus 70, and it's adjusted so that we see it in millivolts. So the voltage across the cell membrane at rest is minus 70 millivolts. And then as time goes on, okay, two different things can happen. The voltage of the cell can move up towards zero. So what's happening to the voltage when it goes from minus 70 to minus 50, minus 40, minus 20, then maybe even zero? What happened to the voltage? It went away, right? It goes away. And what do we call that? We call that depolarization, right? When the voltage goes from RMP to more positive, right? We call that depolarization, and by definition, we're going to call that an excitatory event. When a cell depolarizes, that's excitatory. Right here it says stimulation, stimulatory, that's okay. It means the same thing. Excitatory. All right, if the resting membrane potential moves the opposite way, if it becomes more and more negative, we don't call that depolarization, we call that hyperpolarization. That, by definition, is going to be an inhibitory event. I'd like for you to use excitatory and inhibitory, not necessarily stimulation versus inhibition, because an inhibitory signal is a form of stimulation, right? Okay, so excitation versus inhibition. One last term, after excitation, so here we have a cell that's being excited, and so what's the electrical event that's producing that excitation? The electrical event that produces excitation of a cell, what do we call that? Depolarization. Yeah, it's depolarization, right? And after that excitatory event, that voltage is going to go back down, and the cell becomes restful again. It goes back down to RMP, goes back to rest. We want to understand, we need a term for that, right? What happens when the voltage goes back down to the resting condition, right? So depolarization, when there's less voltage, hyper, when there's more voltage across the cell membrane, when it goes back to the resting condition is what we call repolarization, to get back to RMP. So we can measure these things across the cell. All right, so these membrane potential changes occur by ions moving across the cell membrane. Ions flow through the cell membrane, and since it's an ion, it can't get through the cell membrane unless there's a channel that allows it to do that. Some channels are open, some are closed. It just so happens that for potassium, there are a lot of channels that are always open. We call these leak channels. And there are other kinds of channels that can be closed. But the cell can regulate whether those channels are open or closed. So they're not open all the time or closed all the time. They can change. And there's a couple different kinds. There are voltage-gated channels. And voltage-gated channels are a special kind of protein inside the cell membrane that change their shape when the voltage across the membrane changes. All right, so let's go back to that previous slide. What did we call depolarization? Excitation, right? And so as this voltage changes, that can open up sodium channels, right? And so which way will sodium enter? It will go from outside to inside. And what's that going to do to this little trace right here? Will that cause further depolarization or hyperpolarization or repolarization? Okay, so normally the cell is negative. What happens when sodium goes inside the cell? Becomes more positive, and so that's going to force the voltage to even become more positive when that happens. And what kind of event is that? That is an excitatory event. All right, so there are some channels that just are sensitive to the voltage across the membrane, and they're open by depolarization, which produces what? Even more depolarization. Right? And so that's going to produce a very rapid depolarization, a very rapid excitatory event. Voltage-gated channels are closed for potassium are closed in resting cells. Right? But there are some leak channels that are open all the time, but in particular, the voltage-gated ones are closed in resting cells. Right? And when the voltage changes on the membrane, they can open up, and then potassium can move across the membrane. And you're going to see why that's important. Okay, both these voltage-gated channels for sodium are closed in resting cells. So sodium is really excluded from getting inside the cell. Otherwise, it would rush in if any of these channels were open. All right, so let's take a look at an artist's understanding of some of these voltage-gated channels. I see a nice phospholipid bilayer, right? So we're looking at a cell membrane. Here's a protein that spans all the way across the membrane from the extracellular side to the intracellular side. And it just looks like a block right now that's in the membrane. This is a channel, but we're going to say this is a gated channel. And in this particular time, it is closed. So there are no ions that can move across the membrane. If for some reason we change the voltage across the membrane, it's going to pull and push on different parts of this protein here, and it's going to open up a channel. So now I see a pathway between the extracellular side and intracellular side of the membrane. And if this channel has a particular shape that allows sodium to move through it, guess what sodium will do? It will go from outside to inside. And when it does, what happens to the membrane potential? It's depolarized, right? That's a nice excitatory event. Okay. After a period of time, there's also another part of this channel, and even though the channel is open, it can plug it up. Right? And so here we see a channel that's open, but it's plugged up, and this is what we call the gated part of this channel. So even though it's open, it can still be closed, and this is also due to the voltage on the membrane. And when it's closed, what happens to depolarization? This is probably the important point. When the channel is closed, what happens to depolarization at this point? Remember, sodium enters the cell, that causes depolarization. But when this gate closes, what happens to depolarization? It stops. All right, so this is a nice way of stopping that, right? Because I sort of told you already, when the voltage depolarizes, that opens sodium. Sodium goes into the cell, that causes more depolarization, that will open more channels, which then causes more depolarization. That sounds like a positive feedback mechanism. That can't last forever, and one reason that it stops is because this gate closes and prevents further depolarization of the membrane. All right, so we want to pay attention to voltage-gated channels first and how they can produce something we call an action potential. Where did you run into this word potential before? In resting membrane potential. What's another word for resting membrane potential? What's another word for potential? Voltage. Yeah, when the cell is at rest, okay? Action potential means what's happening to the voltage. If it's an action voltage, it's not steady, it's not constant, it is changing. That's just all it means. It just means that there's a special event where the voltage is changing, right? And this has to do with voltage-gated channels, almost like the one that we were just looking at. All right. So we want to understand the illustration over here on the right. This is pretty much like that oscilloscope screen. This is a plot of voltage across the membrane versus time. Right. And what's RMP typically? Minus 70, right? So here is the cell at rest, okay? And then somewhere something comes along that causes what it goes to minus 70 to maybe minus 55. What do we call that? From minus 70 to minus 55, depolarization. That is produced by a stimulus. That's an excitatory event, right? So a stimulus will produce that depolarization. And if it reaches that threshold of minus 55, something special happens. Look what happens. You have this rapid depolarization. This level right here, minus 55, this is what we call a threshold level. When the voltage on the membrane changes to minus 55, then a bunch of sodium channels open up. And you already told me, what happens when sodium channels open up? Sodium rushes inside the cell because that's the direction of the electrochemical gradient. And when sodium rushes inside the cell, what effect does that have on the cell membrane? It depolarizes even more, right? And then as we get to plus 30 millivolts, look, it stops. Depolarization stops. Why does it stop right here? Because of this gate closes. At that particular voltage, this gate closes. And if the gate closes, then what happens to depolarization? Because that's produced by sodium. It stops. Okay, so depolarization stops. And it just so happens, at about this time, potassium channels open. Where's potassium at a high concentration? Inside the cell. But here, what's the voltage inside the cell? Is it positive or negative? It's positive. So what can you tell me about a positive potassium ion and a positive electrical charge inside the cell? What do like charges do? They repel each other. So what will potassium want to do? It will want to leave because of that electrical gradient. And then where is potassium at a low concentration? Outside the cell. So potassium will want to leave because the electrochemical gradient is going to force it outside the cell. And what happens to the cell voltage when a positive charge leaves? It becomes less positive or more negative. And what do we call this when the cell membrane potential goes back down to RMP? That is, by definition, repolarization. So some of this stuff can actually make sense. Maybe not the first time you hear it, but it can make sense if you just rely on some of that basic physical chemistry that we learned, like opposite charges attract. Same charges repel each other. Things will move from high concentration to low by diffusion. Okay? All right, so this is what we call an action potential. It has two main phases to it. There is depolarization due to sodium rushing inside the cell through those sodium channels that open up, followed by repolarization due to potassium channels that open up, and then that gets you back down to RMP. And the cell can be excited once again. All right, but what is necessary in order for an action potential to initiate? A stimulus. The stimulus has to be at least at this threshold level. There can be a stimulus, but if it doesn't reach threshold, then that stimulus is going to die away without an action potential taking place, right? It has to reach stimulus. If it's more than stimulus, that's fine, right? It will still trigger an action potential. All right, let's go back and look at the left-hand part of this slide right here. So depolarization stimulus, that's, I think we call that an oxymoron, which means what? Depolarization and stimulus mean what? The same thing, right? That reminds me of a really nice neighborhood I lived in Boulder, Colorado. Some of you will think this is really funny. It was called Table Mesa, right? Table Mesa and depolarization stimulus are sort of like the same thing, right? Table and mesa are the same word, just in different languages, right? So Depolarization and stimulus, same word. So you have a stimulus, which is depolarizing, and okay, that's going to open voltage-gated channels, right? This depolarization stimulus. So more sodium diffuses into the cell, down its electrochemical gradient, and when sodium diffuses in, that causes more depolarization, so then it comes back over here, and as the cell membrane depolarizes more, it will even open up more sodium channels, which produces what? More depolarization. So here is, what kind of feedback loop is this? That's a nice positive feedback loop, which then assures that this depolarization phase of an action potential is very rapid. So put this in your little memory bank, that here is an example of positive feedback in what? A very normal, everyday situation or occurrence, right? And that's rare. Positive feedback is rare. All right, but usually something drastic has to change in order to stop a positive feedback mechanism. What's the drastic thing that changes, that stops this positive feedback mechanism? It is? Yeah, that gate closes, right? Because the voltage has just reached that level and it closes, depolarization stops. Okay, the opposite thing down over here, with due to this initial stimulus, voltage-gated potassium channels open, but these are slow. The sodium channels open fast. The potassium are a little bit slow, right? And by the time that gate for sodium is closed, then the potassium channels are finally fully open, and inside the cell is positive, and that's going to repel potassium. Potassium is at a high concentration inside the cell. Potassium will want to leave, right? So potassium diffuses out of the cell, causes less depolarization, and that is going to repolarize the membrane as a result of that. All right, so just remember this little positive feedback mechanism here for those sodium channels. All right, let me go back to this action potential. I would like for you to be able to draw this out, okay? And I'll send you an email. I lost email privileges. I think everybody, can everybody log into Blackboard? There was a problem with Blackboard to where people's passwords were lost. I didn't set anybody's password in here for this class. But if you're having a problem logging in, then send me an email. And the email address is in my syllabus, right? And you can use whatever email service you want. But if you can't log into Blackboard, you can't use Blackboard to email me. That's why you got to know my email address, right? And then I can reset your password. And then you go in and change it back to whatever you want. Okay. So I'll send you an email with the respiration slide that I want you to draw, and also this action potential. And guess what? Does anybody know if this is an exam figure or not? It is an exam figure, right? So you should be able to label this thing, know what RMP is, what threshold is, depolarization, repolarization, what causes depolarization, sodium entering, what causes repolarization, potassium leaving. Here's one thing that I didn't mention. Okay, this repolarization phase, right, we see goes to RMP, but it doesn't stop there. The brakes just don't slam closed, right? All the gates don't slam closed. There still is a period of time right here where there is some hyperpolarization. Remember, hyperpolarization is something, some voltage that's greater than RMP. So here's minus 70, minus 75, minus 80, could be minus 90. That's what we call hyperpolarization. What kind of event did we call hyperpolarization? Inhibition. And this slide shows it very nicely. So let's go back. So if the membrane is hyperpolarized and the cell receives another stimulus of the exact same magnitude of this first one, will it reach threshold? So if we take this height right here of this stimulus and put it down over here, how high is it going to go? It's going to go to right here and stop. Is that threshold? It is not. So a threshold stimulus before the action potential, right, will trigger an action potential, but that exact same stimulus right after during this period right here will not. We call that a refractory period. And so another action potential can't be initiated during this relative refractory period right? Unless some other stimulus comes around and adds to it. Okay? It can be overcome if you have something greater than this initial stimulus. So this area here, hyperpolarization, that means the cell is inhibited. It still can be excited, but it has to be greater than this typical stimulus, threshold stimulus. It has to be greater than a threshold stimulus to meet this new threshold. Yeah. Different cells will be different, but for this class, why don't we just say it's minus 55? Okay. And if it goes from RMP to minus 55, we're going to call that an excitatory stimulus or depolarization. And one really nice way to think about that is by the movement of an ion. What will cause this depolarization? What ion moving? Sodium moving, and which way would it move? From outside to inside the cell, right? And that's typically how a stimulus is generated, is that somehow sodium was able to get inside the cell through a different kind of channel. But we haven't talked about that different kind of channel yet. We're just talking about voltage-gated channels. We're talking about how half of a neuron works, right? And as a matter of fact, this action potential, you could draw it down on the slide, this action potential is found on axons. It's not found on dendrites or cell bodies. It's found on the sending end of a neuron, not the receiving end of a neuron. Okay. Now, if a lot of this stuff sort of doesn't make sense, remember, we have three lectures to talk about this, and you won't really understand it until I tell you everything, which is three lectures. So you're going to just have to try to remember some of this stuff, and don't freak out if it doesn't make perfect sense right now. You have to spend some time with it. Okay, I've talked about everything on this slide right here. I believe at threshold, those voltage-gated channels open. Repolarization, voltage-gated channels for sodium's closed. They slam closed because of that gate. The slow voltage-gated potassium channels are now open, and then potassium leaves the cell. That drags positive charges outside, so now the inside of the cell becomes more negative during that repolarization. All right. Now, this is pretty interesting. We've been talking about sodium moving and potassium moving. What kind of transport was being used? Was it active transport or passive transport? It was all passive transport. So this excitatory stage, or this excitatory ability of both neurons and muscles, right, is just something that naturally happens, right? It's not an active process. It happens passively. So an action potential is a passive process, but then ATP is used to readjust the concentrations of sodium and potassium across the cell membrane. So depolarization and repolarization occur passively, which is the same thing as saying what? By diffusion. So action potential does not require active transport when it's in the process, right? It just needs active transport after the action potential so that the cell can become excitatory once again, right? And then it's that sodium potassium ATP pump that pumps out sodium and pumps potassium back inside the cell. So that's kind of interesting that you have this really important action potential, but it happens passively. Right, just due to those proteins that are inside the cell membrane. This slide right here just says that, or just shows you how that action potential is produced. And let's look at the bottom one. We have the permeability of sodium and potassium across the cell membrane. Right, so this is not voltage, this is permeability versus time. And we see that, what is the first event? It is sodium channels that are opening. And this relates to what? The depolarization. Okay? So, and then all of a sudden, sodium can no longer diffuse because the gate closes. That produces an absolute refractory period. Once the action potential reaches this point right here, there is no way to stimulate another action potential because the gate is closed. So action potentials cannot summate, and there is an absolute refractory period. That neuron has to go dormant until it repolarizes once again. to this point. And then even after that absolute refractory period, there is a relative refractory period where it can be stimulated once again, but you need greater than the usual threshold stimulus on that particular neuron. All right, so permeability to sodium happens first, followed by permeability to potassium. These gates are a little bit slower to act, and that works out perfectly because sodium is responsible for depolarization, potassium is responsible for repolarization. And these voltage changes are caused by, I think this is probably the important thing to see, these voltage changes across the membrane are caused by changes in what? Sodium and potassium permeability through the membrane, right? So the movement of these ions changes the membrane potential of these particular cells. Okay, so that gate, call that an inactivation gate. I don't think I used that term. Here's that inactivation gate. Even though the channel's open, it can become inactivated when this thing closes at the peak of that action potential. Okay, well, I have to stop for just a second and ask and see if anybody has a question. This is all new stuff. I don't know if anybody has a question, but you're going to have to look at it a little bit before you can come up with a question. But if somebody knows they have a question, that would be great at this point in time. Yes. Right here? Yeah. That's where the inactivation gate becomes, that's when it closes.
So, and where is the input happening? Is this an axon?
Yeah, it's on an axon, and we're just going to look at one point right now, just one point on that axon. Okay? And then later, we're going to see that this action potential actually moves along an axon, but for right now, we just want to think of one point on that axon that this thing is existing on. Okay, and then it might move. Okay, and that's sort of interesting. Maybe I can describe something. Remember that on an axon, what can you tell me about the direction of a nerve impulse? It's one way. It only goes one way. Why can't it go backwards? Well, that's because when there is an action potential on one location of the axon, all right, it becomes dormant because of that refractory period. The period of axon right before it, or the portion of axon right before it, is still in a refractory period. It can't be stimulated again. All right? But the parts that are still downstream, distal to where this action potential are, they're still at resting membrane potential. So if they receive a stimulus, they can depolarize. So things can depolarize in front of the action potential, but not behind it because of that refractory period. So action potentials can only go in one direction. So that's pretty handy, if you can see that. I maybe set it okay so that you can see it. Yeah? Anything below RMP. Yeah, so anything below minus 70, that's hyperpolarization. And there could be gradations in that. It could be more or less hyperpolarized, right? If it's maximally hyperpolarized, that means it needs a really strong stimulus to overcome that relative refractory period. If it's just barely hyperpolarized, then it just needs something just a little bit stronger than a threshold stimulus to excite another action potential. Right? And so we call this relative. This one up over here, this is absolute when that inactivation gate closes. And that's one of the reasons why an action potential cannot go backwards down an axon. I like those questions. Those are great. And here is something that's really important, and I don't want you ever to get tricked when you read a question, and I want you to think of this slide. All right, so here we have a cell at minus 70 millivolts. What could you tell me about this cell? Well, that's just at rest, right? Nothing's happening. We can come along with a stimulus, and right at this point in time, and I can see what happens to the cell membrane. Does that trigger an action potential right here? Here's the stimulus. No action potential. So this kind of stimulus, it might be depolarization, but it is what we call sub-threshold. If it's a sub-threshold stimulus, it won't produce an action potential, right? It's always got to reach threshold first. So let's make the stimulus a little bit greater. All right, and when we apply that stimulus, what is produced? An action potential, because this stimulus is at least at threshold, right? It has at least done what? It has at least gone up to the threshold level, and that produces an action potential. All right, so let's go back. All right, let's increase the stimulus a little bit more at some later point in time. It goes back down to RMP, right, so the cell's back at rest. Let's turn up the stimulus a little bit. See, this is a greater stimulus, and what does it produce? One action potential. All right, what's the difference between the first one and the second one? What about the color of these lines? What about the height of these lines? What about the width of that change? It's the same. So action potential number one and number two are the same. Even though the stimulus changes, the intensity of the stimulus changes, the action potential has not changed in any sense, form, or way. All right, well, let's turn up the stimulus even more, cause even a greater depolarization, right? Because that's an excitatory event. So here's the strongest stimulus, and what is that? It's a threshold, so that's going to elicit an action potential, right? So here's the third action potential. And what is this third one compared to the second one? It's the same. Same height. What is it compared to the first one? The same. Even though the stimulus is changing, what can you tell me about an action potential? All action potentials are exactly the same. They never, ever change, right? So please, don't ever be tricked by a question. The question is going to sound like, oh, well, the action potential changes. But what can you tell me about an action potential? They're the same. What about an action potential at the beginning of an axon and the end of the axon? They should be different, but they are exactly the same. Okay, so that's actually pretty phenomenal that that happens. Okay, so we say that this action potential moves down an axon, okay, without decrement. Where is that? APs are propagated without decrement. That means that action potential at the beginning of an axon is exactly the same at the end. As it moves along an axon, that signal does not change. These action potentials are produced by what kind of membrane protein? A voltage-gated channel, right? A channel that opens up or closes depending on the voltage across the membrane. And these voltage-gated channels, right, are only found in one part of a neuron, and that is the sending part. These action potentials are sending information, and the sending part of a neuron is the axon. So only axons have voltage-gated channels. So a lot of information on this slide. All right. And because of that absolute refractory period produced by that inactivation gate, action potentials cannot summate. Or here you can fill this in. Action potentials cannot summate because of the inactivation gate closes that sodium channel, and that just completely obliterates the ability to depolarize any further. Right? So action potentials cannot build on top of each other. Right? So that just means that an action potential will always be the same height. Can't change. And so that means action potentials have a constant amplitude, because that inactivation gate will just make sure that it's always the same. Okay, so action potentials are always going to be the same. They can't summate. They move from one part of a neuron to the other without decrement, without fading away. That's pretty cool. So the question is that I want you to think about is if, well, here's an action potential. An action potential is the language of your nervous system. Okay? And if you were to listen to an action potential, it would just sound like a blip. It would just be a blip. So neurons talk to each other in these little blip kinds of things all over the place, and all these blips are the same. So how is it that you can appreciate when I'm talking really softly, that's a very small stimulus, or if I talk loudly, you still can hear it, but if the action potentials are always all the same, how is it that you can tell a difference in intensity of my voice if all action potentials are the same? Okay, and so that's really the point of the next slide, and that's where we're going to start up next time. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, please. Okay? But what can you tell me about action potentials? No matter where in the universe you look, they're going to be the same.